This is On Being's Unheard Cuts. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to my extended conversation with Richard Feldman. He's a board member of the James and Grace Lee Boggs Center to Nurture Community Leadership. I spoke with him on December 16, 2011, in Detroit, Michigan. This interview is included in our show, Becoming Detroit. Download the MP3 of the produced show at onbeing.org.
So great.
For the next year?
You know, when I would start talking, I could see her. I was trying to be attentive to when I thought she wasn't hearing me.
Yeah.
And was I kind of yelling into the microphone, or is it going to be okay?
It was fine.
Okay, I was worried.
I would have stopped you if it wasn't.
I was thinking about her, and then every once in a while I would say, "Gosh, stop."
Chris, what I'm trying to figure out is,
I think she did.
I always do that.
Photo.
Sometimes I would see her kind of wrinkle her brow,
For video?
And then sometimes I felt like I didn't know if she's getting, and then she'd sit back and completely answer a question.
Okay, put it on. You have the Unipod with you?
She hears enough.
Yeah.
And she also, when she doesn't respond, sometimes I think she's not
thinking.
Hearing, but she's saying, I don't want to respond that way. I'm going to respond the way I want to.
No, I really don't care.
I really don't care. When she did the thing with, I don't know if it was with Bill Moyers or with...
I saw her with Bill Moyers.
It was like she really loves the conversation.
Uh-huh.
You know, she hates interviews such, and
she
you engage in a conversation,
yeah,
you know, and that was cool. That was very cool. Yeah. So that was great. That was very cool.
Did she like the Bill Moyers thing, or did that?
Oh, she loved it. She loved it. She loved it.
Yeah.
She because she thinks and believes that if she engages in an interview and thinks the other person has been thinking, she's happy.
Yeah.
If they're just using her, she is really livid and stuff.
It's also hard. It's strangely hard. However well you think, if you're being asked bad questions or empty questions,
mm-hmm.
it's hard to transcend those questions.
Mm-hmm.
You end up not being your best self as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's an authenticity that's so important. And like there's a guy from, because she was written up in Yes Magazine and nominated by Vincent and Pete Seeger, this radio guy from, you may know him, I don't know, some person in Baltimore, I don't know his name, wants to do an interview. And Grace says, I don't want to really do another interview.
Uh-huh.
And because she's not convinced that he wants to have a dialogue with her. And so the guy said, well, I'll come visit you and I'll come visit Pete Seeger because I really want to do this, right? So, sort of fun. So
you're up there with Pete Seeger.
So am I
this
taking
makes
right?
Make a right and then make a left. I'm
this
sorry.
Makes me think that I've got to write Vincent Harding and tell him I did this.
That's right.
Yeah, he's coming here in the next week or so.
Really?
Yeah, make a left up here.
Okay,
yeah, he wants.
I've never met him in person. I love him.
Oh, you never met him in person?
You give him a hug for me.
I sure will.
His first hug from me.
He's great.
He was emphatic that we come to Detroit and interview Grace.
Well, he talked about Grace, and that was in the show.
I listened to it.
Yeah, and
I called him 5 minutes after I heard of you on him. Because I was in.
Actually, it was kind of a big call because, you know, he was telling a big story. He was introducing this other person, and we decided that it really belonged there. But it was kind of unusual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I called him right at Janice and I listened. We must have been on vacation. I don't know why we were together even.
Yeah.
But we were together, and we had just finished listening to it.
Yeah.
I called him 10 minutes after because he was coming in.
Good.
You know, coming here, and I was ecstatic because you captured him sharing this whole concept of uncertainty and the pain that people are going through that makes them so angry and so scared.
Yeah.
And we just constantly have shared that. So this is Detroit.
Yeah, could you tell us?
Yeah, let me tell you about Detroit. You're on the east side of Detroit. This was obviously a very wealthy, where the upper management used to live in the 20s and 30s and 40s. Where Grace lived, it was still, you could see, pretty strong housing stock. Detroit was the largest homeowner population of any city in the country. It went from as less than 1 million people in 1912, 1913, to 2 million in 1950, to now less than 760,000. Detroit's the size of, so you know, it's the size of 150 square miles, which means it's equal in size to Boston, Manhattan, and San Francisco altogether.
Wow.
And one third of the land is vacant now.
Wow.
Okay. So there's like 1,600 community gardens. This is an old German East Side area. You're approaching.
It's kind of reminding me of Summit Avenue. Tell me this. Are you from Detroit? Did you?
I was born and raised in Brooklyn, New York.
Uh
huh. And moved out to go to school in '67 in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Uh huh.
Got involved in the student movement and
stayed in Detroit.
And moved to Detroit with 30 other people.
So, you know, back then, would you have been surprised that a third of the city would be vacant now?
Absolutely. 1970. Had I read Jimmy Boggs' book, I would have understood. If I understood what he said in 1963.
You might have seen it coming.
Well, he was very prophetic. He saw the role of automation. He saw the movement of the plants outside the city. 85% of all the jobs in the metro area were in Detroit in 1970. There's fewer than 11% now. In fact, there was just a conversation on the news today about a light rail system. You're going to make... I guess you're going to have to make a right and then a Michigan left because the coffee place is to the left, but you can't make a left on this street.
So I'm pretty sure that when they're talking about outlawing cell phones and handless devices, that if they knew about holding a camera while driving, they would outlaw that too. But
you'll see, you'll have plenty of chances of pictures without doing them now.
Also, I had to tell you, last time I was in a moving car with Trent holding a camera.
Make a right, and then you'll have to make a left.
We were in Ramallah and were then pulled over by the Palestinian Authority.
That's true. We spent some time.
I think this will be less eventful.
Yeah, so they were just in Washington, the mayor and the governor giving up on the idea of a light rail system because they want buses in the suburbs and how much federal money they were going to get. So it's a real city suburban discussion. Continue it, make a left, pull the left U-turn right here.
So there was going to be light rail in
there. Light rail, which was the part that's being still holding on to the old paradigm, but it has to be, happens to be where all the hospitals are. Stay on the left. Yeah. And then at the first, you're
going
to go to Tim Hortons.
It's across the, you see it, Trent?
Well, I want.
You're going over there to Tim Hortons.
Right over there, Tim Hortons. See it?
Yes.
Okay. We're working with people to create their own motorbikes, and we have to create our own forms of communication. You go up to the left a little further.
So you're not for the light rail.
Not for the light rail is not gonna. It's not a significant question, and the reason they're doing it is really so folks can come and go from the medical complex.
I see.
So it's the rather than.
It's not about connecting.
It's not about connecting or about creating community. It's about how do you create a middle class enclave within the city still and keep pushing out most of the population. Which is what, you know.
Are we stopping in or driving through?
Let's drive through.
All right.
I just really need some coffee.
What can I get for you?
Okay. Thank you for choosing Tim Hortons. I'm gonna make you really sick, Trent. I'm gonna get flavored coffee.
Okay. What's the flavor?
I'll get hazelnut coffee. Large. With lots of room and lots of cream.
A large hazelnut coffee with lots of room for lots of cream, and if you could put lots of cream in it.
A large coffee?
Yes. Hazelnut?
And are you guys going to get something?
I'll get a...
How many creams?
Six.
Six?
Six?
I guess.
Well, yeah, at least. What are you guys getting?
I don't want anything.
I have a small hazelnut too, with cream.
I mean, sugar.
No sugar.
No sugars, and then one small hazelnut, as well, with cream.
Where's your home?
Cream. One small hazelnut.
Well, we live
with cream.
In Minnesota. In
Minnesota.
I grew up in Oklahoma. My kids are growing up in Minnesota, so it feels like home.
Yes, ma'am.
That'd be
all.
Yes.
$3.
All that for $3.
Do you know Fritjof Bergmann's name?
Yeah, I do.
He was actually my old professor when I was a kid. He's returned back to Detroit. He's done this whole thing on new economy, new work, and new culture.
Right.
And he's working with us.
Yeah, I don't know what I say.
He's another...
$3 on the card?
prophetic person, and it's been wonderful to reconnect. But he left, he did this, started this thing in Flint in the 80s. Nobody was ready for it in the 80s. He went to India and Africa. He's been doing stuff in Africa on technology and so forth. And now he realized Detroit is ready. And so he's been part of this reconnecting of everybody. And it's, I think we're going to see some breakthroughs on how people can actually make a living through new forms of work that are locally related, beyond the farming and the urban gardening in Detroit in this next period. And Fritjof is part of it, which is exciting because he brings a whole international skill set that we really didn't have here.
Yeah, the question I kept asking Grace, I was asking for other people as much as anything else, because it's that, you know, I think there's a mentality, this is how can you talk about imagination when people can't pay, can't get medical and health insurance, you know what I mean? And then we get actually psychologically completely, not just tripped up on that, but debilitated.
That's
by
right.
It.
Oh, we're victims of the institutional concepts that have emerged.
Right. And it's compassion, you know, it's all good human reactions, but in fact it's paralyzing.
But it's
whether you're going through it or you know people are going through it or you think I could be next, and that is perfect.
So you're gonna pull, you're gonna go right when you get out, and then you're gonna go left. Are they right behind us? Okay.
It was interesting. I don't know if you heard, we did this series, which we had different people on who'd been on the show before, and then listeners called, which we called Repossessing Virtue. And it was about reactions to the economic downturn. And especially the younger people, like, what everybody really wanted to talk about is how do we take care of each other?
That's
like,
right.
Who will we be for each other? And the fact that that's the question nobody knew how to
answer. No. You're going to go straight and pull a U-turn and go backwards. And then we're going to take it about 8 minutes, and you'll go to Feed 'em Freedom, and then we'll stay there for about 15 minutes, and then we'll go see Gloria's, because you really have to hear Gloria tell her story. And then we'll drive you back to where you got to go, to Ferry Street. But you were saying, I'm sorry.
Well, just that, you know, it's not just that that's not a question we can answer. That we've lost a lot of the ways we would have just intuitively answered it with families and neighborhoods, but we hardly know how to ask that question in the culture, how to live into that question.
And partially that's sort of what was the magic about Occupy. Folks saw themselves recreating in a very small way a community,
physically coming
and making decisions together and caring about each other. And then in many of the cities, because the homeless population is there, they then began to create these compassionate relationships and had to deal with all that.
Right.
So in Detroit now, they split for the winter, and they are now bringing some of the folks that they met and putting them in homes, right?
Yeah.
And creating wood-burning stoves, and this, you know, you have plenty of space here and stuff to do that. Why Detroit is where it's at is because this all started in 1980. We've had 30 years of living with what people think is a crisis, a global economic crisis. And folks have known, not obviously, you know, but enough folks have known that sort of protest politics or expecting the government or the corporations to come back has been a total, it's an absurd thought. And then to be able to magnify that to a global sense, that they're dysfunctional. And so you have to deal with all the questions you're raising. Is we've been very fortunate in many ways.
There's that necessity of time that it's hard to see, right? You can't see it. You only see it then when you see the fruits of it.
And that we were talking yesterday, I guess it was yesterday, because there's a bunch of us that meet weekly with Grace. One guy is Ron Scott, who was the founder of the Black Panther Party, who is creator of these Peace Zones for Life, who was talking about the future and the past, saying that within the seeds of his past was the future in many ways. And really Because we were talking about some of Meg's work of emergence, yeah, of ideas and reality. And then Shay Howell, who's also, she and I have been working with Jimmy and Grace since we were like 20s. And she was saying there's still a disconnect and we don't know how to create the connection between understanding history and the process that young people are so good at now, creating ways for people to tell their story, become personally empowered.
Right.
But how does history and how does this moment, you know, there's a reason it can happen that we haven't, and usually they're folks either process-oriented or content-oriented.
Yeah.
And where do they fit together and how do they fit together? It's just a amazing moment because folks know that, you know, there's enough people around, there's people don't know where else to go except to begin to ask each other these questions.
Right.
I don't know. It's an exciting place to be. I'm so glad, so honored. You were always, as soon as the book, you were on the list for a long time to say, how do we get a hold of him? How do we get a hold of him? Janice, my wife, has written to you, not to you personally, but to wherever the emails ever go in the world, a number of times about Grace. So it was very cool.
Has she really?
Yeah.
Because it was, I'm sure it made a difference. Because as
she makes me listen to you on Sunday morning.
It was suddenly staring us in the face. And it was just this, oh yeah. So, when you start getting close to the story of Detroit, like when you make a connection with somebody from here, you start hearing this. But it is also kind of an unseen, untold story.
Absolutely.
Out there.
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah. I mean, Detroit is the what everybody points at as where the crisis is epitomized.
That's right.
Is that the old?
This is the power plant. This is a water system plant over here on the right.
Do people, like, we did an event, we thought we were coming to Detroit a few months ago, and we were in Birmingham, Michigan, and I'm like, this isn't Detroit.
Right.
Do people in Birmingham, Michigan know this story?
Well,
do they feel like they're part
of it? No, I think, I wouldn't even say majority of the people in Detroit know this story. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, and we know that it's, that's the challenge, is how do you get the story and the narrative told?
Yeah.
Because that's what you're really fighting over. You're not fighting over who has the power. You're fighting over the story and the history and why we're at where we're at. And 5 years ago would have been it was unimaginable to walk up to anybody on the street and say, you know, I just went to an urban garden and they're talking about growing food for everybody in Detroit. They would have said, you can do that. You can have that conversation now in Detroit. People know it's on the agenda. It's not like they all say, oh, that's a wonderful thing, right? Because it still is a big leap, right?
Yeah.
And there's 1,600 community gardens now in Detroit.
Wow.
And folks, you know, 5 years ago, you couldn't say the jobs are not coming back. And everybody would nod, yes, the jobs are not coming back. Now, because it became a national conversation, you can walk up to anybody in Detroit and they know the jobs aren't coming back. And anybody who thinks the jobs are coming back is just wanting to believe. I mean, people don't believe an FDR resurrection today, except radicals. Because they still have that model that the government can save us.
Yeah.
And a lot because they don't understand technology, or they just, we look for old solutions for pain, you know, right? You know, the medical one you were raising.
Yeah, right.
So I think the story gets told, you know, in the way that the reason we're at this place in many ways is when Detroit summer happened, it was the very close nurturing of young people, very mothering relationships that emerged as we had these Detroit Summer Projects, and Grace telling the story globally over and over and over. and it being prophetic in many ways. But it's all about the story. All about the story.
You guys have to listen to our Christmas show with this guy on the prophets. It's really great, and it speaks to this.
Okay.
When she was talking about consumerism, that's all I was hearing.
Yeah, no, he says it's pretty serious. I mean, what did he say?
We used to burn. Well, I'm sorry.
We have given into a culture of death.
A culture of death.
We define ourselves.
It's narcoticized.
Oh, it's narcotic.
Against
right.
the truth.
Yeah. Right.
And the church of the 20th century was the shopping mall.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
We in 1980 put out. We had one event where we burned credit cards as a way to respond to the consumerism back in 1980, right. as a way to sort of challenge it. So this is the East Side. It's a really you're only going to be a mile less than 5 blocks from Grosse Pointe. Okay, these streets, if you look to the left, and we'll go up one of them. In 1980, were filled with houses. That's one of Wayne's artwork right there. Actually, I think that we'll stop by on the way back.
Block after block.
Block after block after block. I'm sorry, but I'm not even paying attention here. A few more blocks.
So I was telling these guys, I came to Detroit when I was in college.
Get on the right, make a right here at Manistique, if you can.
Like 81.
Uh-huh.
And with a friend who lived in Grosse Pointe.
Uh-huh.
And I remember we drove here from Rhode Island, and we, actually Jeff Eugenides, you know, who has written
uh-huh.
books.
You're gonna go the house right past this hoop house.
And I just was so struck.
So you pull a U-turn and you can park in front of this.
Oh, here we are. By what it felt like turning a corner into another world of Grosse Pointe.
Yeah.
I mean, I couldn't believe how it was a couple of blocks.
And that was 1980.
You're
4 blocks from Grosse Pointe.
And also, it's not just that it went from a poorer neighborhood to a richer neighborhood. Even then, it struck me as kind of obscenely rich, right?
It is.
Nothing was two stories.
No, it's a ruling class. I mean, there is a real ruling class of people who live some, you know. Great. This will be fun. Yep. How do I do this? So this street, actually the next one over is Marlborough Street. Just give you a story. In 1982, we had met this guy, Steve Hamilton, who had just come out of prison. And he was a poet, and he lived on the street on Marlborough. And he and his lady friend and daughter, for Halloween, we organized a massive Halloween party. Hundreds of kids in the street. And Detroit had begun to have houses burning. It was called Devil's Night, where on the night before Halloween and Halloween night, people would just burn houses, and arsonists would also come and burn houses. And Steve, and I can never remember her name, stayed up all night on the street after this party, and it was the only street not to burn. And it was, in many ways, the beginning of the idea that, well, the reason you can have crime is because people are inside their house, because people are behind their locked doors. They're not in the community. And now they have Angels Nights, where there's thousands and thousands of people in Detroit on the streets. So I'm not saying we were the catalyst to make that happen, but it was the, you know, similar idea of how do you, you know, prevent, you know, continued violence against each other. It's people just have to be public, you know.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. So.
This is really sad, though. These houses and storefronts that used to belong to people.
Mm-hmm. But in many ways, you know, the success of the American Dream was also the destruction of a city like this, because it created all the suburban sprawl.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And let alone people leaving because the cities became black, they were leaving. as well, because they wanted that land and that American dream, right?
Yeah.
What Jimmy Boggs wrote about in 1963 was that because of the automation, for the first time in human history, people would not be needed to work. And an underclass and an outsider class would be created, i.e. 2.5 million people in prison, you know, and everything that follows from that. And I went into the plant and spent 30 years in a Ford plant.
You did?
Yeah, I did. I worked on the line for 20 years, 10 years as an elected official, and I work for the International Union now. And wrote this book called End of the Line, Auto Workers and the American Dream in 1988, which was...
What did you see in 1988?
Well, if you think about it, 80 was the beginning of this all. So by 88, it was clear that jobs weren't coming back. It was clear that this whole concept of consumerism and materialism had, that we had basically sold our lives for, and our souls for the dollar bill and consumerism. So it was a juxtaposition discussion of how we traded a quality of life for a standard of living, you know, not knowing what the results would be, you know. And it was an interview, it was an oral history of people I worked with in the shop, because I was getting ready to quit. But I didn't, because my second kid was born and it would have been 6 months without an income, so I decided to stay. It was all about what is quality and what is security, imposing individualism versus community, imposing quality of life versus the economic standard of living. And but everybody did a conversation. They shared their own histories of where they came from, why they went into the plants, what the questions they were facing in their lives, what their dreams were. It was wonderful. It was a wonderful experience, a sort of a gift for the folks in the shop. This is where Jimmy Boggs was a local member of UAW Local 7. I don't know if Grace used the phrase that there used to be 15,000 Chrysler workers that worked in this plant to the right called Jefferson Assembly. Now there's a couple thousand.
What do they do with all the extra room?
Oh no, it's been redone many times to plant, okay. So it's pretty much used. But Grace will often say that she used to be, there were so many Chrysler workers on the east side of Detroit that you could throw a dime up and it would hit someone on the head. So I was wondering if she used that in there in your interview. That's why I was asking. But we just had, what was it, part of these reconnections in, is that Eastside River, River East church organizations, these group of 15 churches, they had their resource fair at that local union hall. Because part of my dream has been to, how do you reconnect the workplace with the union again and with the community? Because people just come in, they drive here, and then they leave. Mm-hmm. And there's no relationship. So we've been, this is the first time in my union's history since the early years, when people lived and worked near each other before they drove 40 miles in 14 different directions to work, right? That there's now a reconnection, because I have this amazing vice president, a 42-year-old Latina woman, who understands what this crisis is about, and a president who actually understands it more than any of them have in the last 30 years. So it's fun. I get a chance to have connections in my life that I haven't often had. Hmm. I've had work, politics. Yeah.
Is your wife involved in this?
My wife is very, well, my wife is, we were all raised, I mean, Jimmy and Grace sort of are, been our mentors for
really?
30 years. Janice and I have been married for 30-some years. And she comes out of the women's movement and the health movement, and then has been doing what's called, she works with parents and professionals who have kids with disabilities. It's called the Dance of Partnership, Why Do My Feet Hurt? and has done poems, and I gave you a whole bunch of stuff that she's written, because in many ways, Micah, our son, who has a disability, cognitive impairment, has been our teacher for so many things. I never understood sort of fits together in wonderful ways. Jimmy wrote in 1980s something called The Job Ain't the Answer, when we were trying to figure out how to organize during this period of the early crisis of the 80s starting, right after OPEC. And never understood what it meant. It sounded good, you know, you say things and words don't have meanings for a lot, unless you get smarter, I guess, or older. And Micah, who, because of his disability.
This is your son.
My son Micah, yeah, I'm sorry. Because of his disability, and most people with disabilities, right, 85% unemployment and so forth and so on, never really can be successful in America because they can't consume or produce. Yet they do have meaning as human beings, really profound meanings, right? And gifts and contributions and so it was growing up with Micah and understanding that more and more with this philosophical background that helped me understand what it meant to reimagine work and reimagine life and ways that and Micah is fully included. In fact, he is actually moving now to Syracuse, New York to be a teaching assistant in the School of Disabilities. He has a 40 IQ. But he speaks all over the country. He doesn't speak or write as you or I would. He uses Dragon Speak and uses screen reader. And
I don't even know what that is, but
well, screen reader is you just put the cursor on the your computer screen and it reads to you. And Dragon Speak is a technology that he speaks and the words come out. So he does Facebook, he does emails, he does he does all this stuff.
So and because of Micah, you could not get into the kind of way we're trained to think in this culture, that one of the things you're raising your child to do is have a good job, right? What are you going to do when you grow up? Which becomes a question that is much more defining than what job you're going to have.
I think that's critical. The other part of it, the foundation, was I was a child of the 60s, so I was very involved in SDS and went to Chicago, went to Woodstock, hung around with revolutionaries, did all. So it was in my who I was anyway. I'd already defined myself, but it wasn't inevitable that I would continue on that definition. I could have said security for Micah meant how do we just make lots and lots of money to create security,
right?
But he was raised with great expectations, and it's not how much he grew, but it's how much the community around him grew, and that we knew from the movement. That his security depended on the community, not on him, even though you want him to, you know, to gain skills and all that. And so often parents will speak, Janice and I will speak to parents groups, and the first question they'll say is, what's going to happen when you to Micah when you die? Right? And I say, you know, 40 years ago, we wouldn't have been in this room having this conversation. So it's about this question of time. Mm-hmm. 40 years from now, we don't know how he's going to live, but he's reaching his potential as a human being because of the Montgomery bus boycott, because of what parents are doing, all this stuff. Mm-hmm. Then I also tell him we have a daughter who's a lesbian. Her life would have been really shit 40 years ago, and she's had a chance to live her life.
Yeah.
And so you understand, you know, I've had the privilege of understanding change in real significant ways, in personal ways, as well as larger social ones.
I think this is what's stunning me here. I spend a lot of time listening to, you know, how people in this culture, including me, change for us as biological beings is stressful, right? And we are now collectively in this moment of change, and it's hard and painful, and it brings out the worst in people in a lot of ways. You know, I think that's part of what's going on and with the toxicity of our political life. It's the human factor. And here I am in Detroit, and I feel like, What did you just say? I mean, it's like experiencing change as a privilege. And I'm picking that up everywhere we go. It's like the gift of change.
Wait till you hear Gloria's story. I don't know how much she'll get into it, but I'll make sure I send you the link to the full story on radio. It's unbelievable. And there's story after story after story. When people say Detroit, they just have faceless. They don't know. It means nothing.
Figures, right? It's the numbers of jobs that have been lost. What did you say? A third of the city is not there anymore. It's the pictures of the boards over doors, right?
Yeah.
That's actually not the story.
That's right.
Or it's only a very, very slanted way to tell the story.
Pull in right behind her. That'd be great. I was just saying, you should come back when Margaret Wheatley's here. We'll give you a tour for a day.
Okay.
Just have fun. You don't even have to bring all your machinery if you want. Just to come, it'd be a treat. Because
Krista doesn't go anywhere without machinery.
Okay, well, bring all the machinery, as long as you're...
I'm not allowed to go anywhere.
You're not allowed to.